Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Before we jump into our program, I will remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And those of you who are calling in at 410-319-8888, call in. My producers will send me on another screen, let me know who's calling in, so we will not miss your calls this hour. New technology, we'll have to just work our way around it. Or you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, as Wendy did. We'll read that. And you can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888 is the number. So there's an exhibit that opened up at MICA that I went to the opening of that was really pretty extraordinary. It's at the Fred Lazarus IV Center for Graduate Studies, and it is Baltimore Rising, and it's artists interpreting the uprising that took place in Baltimore, but it could also be interpreting the uprising taking place in America. And it's some amazing work is there. We're here with three of the people who are involved with that. J.M. Giordano, you know, has been on the show many times. He's the photo editor for the Baltimore City Paper, and his work hangs there, and so does his face in somebody else's picture.
Devin's photo, yeah.
So, J.M., good to see you.
Thank you, Mark.
Paul Rucker has also been a guest on the show numerous times, a visual artist, musician, and more, has a really interesting piece I may start the conversation out with at the exhibit. And Paul, good to have you back in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks.
And Tony Shore's in the house. He's chairperson of the painting department at Maryland Institute College of Art at MICA and curated this exhibit, if I'm right.
Yes.
Yes, I am right. It's good to be right sometimes. Good to see you, Tony. Thanks. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. By email, tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I'll look at the little screen, see if you all call and get you right on the air, 410-319-8888. You know, one of the things that struck me about the piece you put up, Paul, as I said to you when I saw you, knowing your work, is that this has to be a Paul Rucker piece.
I hope that's good, right?
It's good. It's good. It's good. It's really good. Well, A was the cello.
Okay.
but that you played, I'm sure. You playing. Mm-hmm. But you took this Confederate dollar bill and describe it. I mean, I think that it's just really powerful because you don't know it's a Confederate dollar bill as it opens up. And you just have this kind of graphics of two black men hoeing in a field.
Yeah, I took it's a Confederate $100 bill, and it was made in 1862, about a month before the Emancipation Proclamation. But slaves were such an integral part of the South and the wealth that they put slaves on the bills. And Baltimore is a major supplier of slaves to the South. This was a major stopping point for ships going down to Louisiana. And I mean, cotton sales alone in 1860 were $200 million. That would equal $5 billion today. And this is something we don't learn in history books. And for me to create this piece more about, we haven't dealt with the legacy of our role in slavery, our role, we haven't dealt with race. And if you look at the history of Baltimore policing, which, you know, Freddie Gray was directly affected by, you look at the Baltimore police, uniform police started in 1865. So, I mean, they basically are the fifth branch of the military. I mean, we're under a police state. We've always been under a police state since then. So, and the unjustified arrest of Freddie Gray, it all ties in for me, never dealing with this legacy. And the impact and contribution of slaves is one of the reasons we're here today.
So, and the pieces that hang in this exhibit, I mean, they all kind of really push, I think, the envelope a little bit visually about what we're facing as a city, as a society.
Yeah, it was really important for me in bringing the work together to bring a bunch of different perspectives, addressing not just sort of the events following the death of Freddie Gray, but also to bring together a lot of the systemic and racial issues that had been sort of boiling up to that point. So there's work in the show that I think the oldest piece in the show is probably from Joyce Scott from like 17 years ago. And that piece is as relevant today as it was when she made it, which I guess says something about how needed it is to sort of continue to look at these ideas and just sort of think about them and be confronted with them.
And Joe, your work is hanging. So are you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the pieces that Tony chose, and he also should say that they're, he based a series of paintings on the photos, which I'm extremely honored to have done with my work. They were from an incident that happened in Sandtown during the Camden Yards incidents, where Baynard Woods and I, a writer, went up to Sandtown to kind of see what the police were up to. And we were right. They, it looked like an occupation up there by the precincts. It was and this was just residents up there. This was not the protesters that they came from elsewhere. This was just a neighborhood, and it went downhill starting at about midnight. But also in the show is Devin Allen's work, who is an extremely important young photographer, probably closest we'll have to a young Gordon Parks, I think. Quite literally, in the work that he's doing, still within the community and in his professional life. And yeah, I'm in one of his photographs, which is a really kind of funny story, because when I was very young, my dream was to be in Time magazine. So not exactly how I wanted to be in there, but but I'm in one of his photographs. So you should definitely go take a peek at those. They're fantastic.
Right, and the uprising really did put his work on the map.
Oh yeah, of course. And it was all through Instagram. I mean, you know, his story is one of those American success stories. He was recording everything on Instagram, making sure the world knew what was going on, and he just took off like a rocket. So
I wonder, when you look at when you have a town like Baltimore, where there's a really large community of artists. I mean, larger than people. I mean, we don't realize how many. I mean, partially because of Micah, but also because of Towson. Morgan's art department. There's tons of like art departments in the city, high schools that are dedicated to the arts in Baltimore County and Baltimore City, and there are a lot of artists in the city, painters, sculptors, photographers, all kinds, working people with lithographs, and many of these artists are really deeply involved in what's happening in the city in terms of the social political issues facing Baltimore. So, how important is that? I mean, what does that mean to have artists in the midst of this? I mean, your exhibits out there, but Paul.
I got to tell you, I think one of the reasons you're leaving out that there are a lot of artists here, because the affordability is one huge aspect, and Micah and the other schools that are producing a lot of these art students. But, I mean, when I moved here three years ago, I mean, I noticed that there are a lot of people who actually really care about what's going on. I mean, I think there are a lot of cities in the USA you can avoid the issues, but you can't. The patchwork quilt of disparity in Baltimore's landscape, you can't avoid it, and it's in your face.
Yeah, no. You can't avoid it.
No, I mean, Baltimore is definitely an apartheid city, and I've talked to Dr. Brown from here, from Morgan.
Lawrence Brown,
yeah, Larry Brown, who's a friend of mine. We spoke together at a Ignite talk, and we didn't know each other, but we talked about the same thing, so we got together afterwards. And, I mean, the city is extremely divided, right down apartheid lines, so it's very difficult. You know, Baltimore is a very difficult city, and now with the current political climate, it's going to be a rough 4 years.
Or 8 years.
Oof. We'll come back to that point. I want to talk about this and where you see this going.
Yeah, and I think in terms of sort of the, I don't know that people often realize the caliber of artists connected with Baltimore. I mean, within this group of artists that are just involved in this show, and this number, there are 15 artists in the show, there could have just as easily been 25 artists. Just the accolades that these people have received. I mean, within the past probably 3 months, there are between 5 artists in the show have received over $750,000 just to make their work. I mean, Joy Scott being the big one that makes up most of that money.
It was amazing. She won the MacArthur. So beautiful. Yeah.
And well-deserved.
Yes, absolutely.
She's a MacArthur Genius Grant winner.
Yeah.
But Derek Adams just won a huge award from the Studio Museum of Harlem. Both Sonia Clark and Shanique Smith both won awards from Anonymous as a Woman. Lauren Adams just won a Trawick Prize down in Bethesda. And we've got a number of Baker Prize winners like Paul. Myself, I was a Sondheim winner from a while back. But it's just there's the caliber of artists who are in Baltimore and who really are not afraid to take on these issues in their work. I mean, for me, a big part of sort of pulling this show together with these artists was there was an immediate response that happened. So after Freddie Gray, there were murals that went up and there were fundraisers and there were a number of things going on. But I think for a lot of artists, I know for myself personally, you know, I need time to live with things in the studio before I actually sort of spout out my opinion on it. I need to spend time thinking about it and sort of really, investigate my own emotions. And when I saw Joe's photographs, actually, from that the battle of Sandtown Winchester, there those nighttime photos just sort of struck a nerve with me because I work on velvet all the time. And it just connected that, like, I felt as though I wanted not just his photos to be photojournalism, but to give them a second life so that they could actually continue to resurface and show up in other places in different ways. But, yeah, there's just an amazing amount of talent in this show. Nate Larson, Jeffrey Kent, Susan Waters Ellers. Incredible group.
And Derek Adams' work. Sorry, Mark. Yeah, Derek Adams' work is one of my favorite pieces, King, because I'm from Baltimore, and I remember those eight ball jackets. You know, you have to go. That's a very powerful statement from back in the day where people were getting, you know, they were very coveted eight ball jackets. And that's a good Baltimore reference that a lot of the pieces in the show, you know, don't really tie into the city. But that one specifically ties to a generational thing and a period.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic piece.
I too remember sort of growing up at that time period, and it was your Jordans and your leather jacket were getting stolen. And that was like what was the big trend at that point. But that piece in particular, Derek has talked about it as it's from a series of pieces he did about sort of the black body and architecture in Baltimore. So inside of the body part of that black jacket is a brick wall that's painted black. But then on that brick wall, there's an X in a square, which alludes to everything from, you know, checking your race on a job application, checking if you're a felon, to the X's on the Katrina homes, all the way down to it just being an X as a target on a black man's body.
Let me open the phones here, folks. Your thinking and thoughts at 410-319-8888 as we approach the artists looking at our city and their interpretation of it and also the power of socially aware and active artist in our town. 410-319-8888. Ayize, you're on the air. Welcome.
Brother Mark, thank you so much, and to the WEA family, peace to everyone. Thank you for another great show, another slam dunk. I appreciated just a few points, if I could.
Sure, please, go ahead.
I appreciated your opening with respect to the legendary Gwen Ifill. May she definitely rest in peace. The second point around the organizing around this moment, I would say talk is good, but some would say it was cheap too. So let's try, you know, action speaks louder than words. So my challenge would be to, you know, WEA listeners to see if we'd be interested in doing, you know, monthly community gatherings. Maybe we can do something at Red Emma's and see if Brother Mark, if you would even be one of the hosts, so that we could plan a progressive movement from the ground up and move on, you know, this moment. Last point I want to make is the show sounds great, yet I would encourage, I'm not sure who of your people that are in office, I mean in the studio now, talked about the slaves. I would, you know, the young folk I work with, I'd tell them that that's a curse word. And no, our people weren't the S word. They were resistors or freedom seekers and not three-fifths dehuman people. If you believe Black Lives Matter, I would say we shouldn't use that word anymore. So, great show. Keep up the great work.
There's always. Thank you so much, AC. There are always arguments over words and how we use them. Paul?
Actually, I want to respond to that. That piece is called When We Were Useful. Now, I use that language, When We Were Useful, not from my perspective of, like, we were useful then and we're not useful now. I think it's really important when we have conversations, whether it be at Red Emma's or anywhere else, actions speak loud, but you can have this preaching to the choir aspect, which I think is one of the things that got us in the situation today. We're not inviting enough opposition or voices that don't agree with us to have a conversation. And I use slaves, I use slavers, I use a lot of different terms, but I think what's really important is, I mean, we can definitely control the narrative in many ways, and but I think the word slave being used and us not knowing the history of what happened when is an even bigger issue. Talking about our history and not being able to tell me when the Emancipation Proclamation happened, not telling me when Plessy versus Ferguson happened, and not knowing that, you know, Baltimore was a site for the most elaborate redlining plan in this whole country that was other places were based on. What concerns me are not just small words, but the bigger issues of not knowing our history today.
And, you know, I think words are important, and we do debate how we use words, and that's also part of art and artistry as well. I think that, you know, then, and because when I think about that, if we don't, that the enslavement of African people in this country is what built the capitalist system in the world. That helped not just this country, but the entire Western Hemisphere. That built the world capitalist system. That's where the money came from, was the genocide against Native people taking their lands and then placing enslaved Africans on those lands to create profit for other people.
We can keep going, right? With the Chinese as well. Chinese, we can keep going.
Right, to all of them, right?
Yes.
But what he was saying is also true, that, so I think within that, maybe not using that word, and that could be a debate we could have, and I think it'd be an interesting conversation to explore in some depth. But the other part is resistance. What's coming to the fore now about history is that resistance always took place. Resistance was not just about the Underground Railroad. Resistance took place on the plantations. It took place in the swamps. We're now discovering all these maroon communities that lived in the Great Dismal Swamp and other places that resisted for decades and decades, living a free life. You know, I mean, the resistance was always there.
No, I can talk. I could probably talk about resistance because I've actually studied a lot of resistance. My next piece coming up is called Red Summer in 1919. Red Summer happened. We had 35 riots across the country, and it was one of the best examples of Black resistance. But even though hundreds of Blacks were lynched and hung, and I mean, they were mob killings, and we're about to hit the 100th anniversary of this racial tension and these mass riots across the country. And I'm bringing this up because my show Rewind was basically about us not understanding history and things coming back again, repeating themselves over and over again. And if we don't understand how far we've come as a country or what things have happened where our mistakes were in the past, then we don't know. And I think people know about Nat Turner now. I've been working about Nat Turner, you know, the 1831 raid for years. But now it's in popular culture, this whole Birth of a Nation thing. But there's more than one or two examples of resistance out there. I think that is important. But we also need to acknowledge that over 5,000 lynchings that happened between 1868 and 1968. We need to acknowledge that that happened. And we have to acknowledge that no one was ever prosecuted for those lynchings. So I do believe in resistance, but also need to acknowledge all the lives that were lost during that time. And I can say there were lynchers out there, but I also say that my people, we were lynched. And I'm not going to change that word or phrasing or narrative.
So the power of which you said those words, that's the idea when we look and see what's happening in Baltimore, even around the country right now.
Yes.
How you see the role and work of an artist in the midst of all this? I mean, there are a lot of our artists would say, don't politicize me. I don't want to be in politics. I'm an artist. Leave me be, right? And others who say, no, my art's really, yeah, I understand that, but my art's really important, and it has to be in the forefront of this work, and I can express things in ways that words cannot always. So, what are your thoughts on that? On the work that you do, and what it means to this moment.
Well, I mean, I'm a photojournalist, Mark. I'm not the caliber of most, like the artists that are in this show. I'm not the caliber of those guys. What I do is, through my social documentary, through my work with City Paper, is to keep issues in the forefront of people. Like we just did the J. Vance story thing. We're working on I'm working on a long term photo essay on living without heat in Baltimore, you know, and this is how I'm dealing with it. And with this new administration, you know, there's going to be crackdowns on the First Amendment. You know, all these.
We're talking about Trump now.
Yeah, I'm just touching on it.
Touch as much as you want.
I'm not saying the word president. so with this new administration, you know, we're going to see some First Amendment crackdowns, and you know, all these people that were in the South that were worried about the Second Amendment. Well, I'm worried about the First Amendment. And I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing out there on the street and putting all these issues in people's faces and force them to see it.
I think Joe just pointed out something. I mean, I think doing a piece about heat, I mean, one of the most powerful things is about art is it makes the unseen seen, and it helps people understand things. And I think that's part of our role, but there has to also be this level of empathy in the community to actually take that in. And there's that danger of, again, preaching to the choir. You know, people who care or maybe are probably going to care more. But I disagree with I think art is equal. I mean, photojournalism, I think art is equal.
Absolutely.
Period.
I agree.
So.
Yeah, and at this moment, you know, in what's going on with the election, there's been so much of an uproar in social media. And I don't know how many artists I've seen that are, like, starting new Facebook groups. To actually, because they can't even focus on their work in their studio. And as someone who's a professor at an art school, I think sometimes it takes moments like this to bring content back into fashion. Not that it needs to be fashionable, but I feel like a lot of times when people are comfortable, it's easy to overlook things. Someone told me the other day, it was just sort of in a joking conversation, they said the two great things that are going to come out of this Trump presidency is that art's going to get better and punk rock's going to come back. But, I mean, you know, not to make light of it, but it's I think that –
That'll make some people happy.
I see periods of sort of – I've been at Mica for a long time, and so you see waves of sort of – you know, content-heavy work or sort of, you know, abstraction that sort of becomes more about sort of process and less about issues. I used to teach a class there that was called Cultural Perspectives, where we addressed issues of race and class and gender and culture, all these things through the artwork that the students were making. And it was a really good class, and it ran for a while, and it sort of died off. But it's a class that when it stopped, it was kind of with the age of cell phones and other things that were happening. And there was so much that we said in the classroom that was very sort of push-button conversation and provoking to the point where now I'm going to bring that class back again next year. But as a part of it, we're going to have student contracts that they have to sign knowing what they're getting into, and a no cell phone policy so that we can have open conversations and not have to worry about something being recorded or taken out of context, because we need that open space to be able to have those conversations.
That's really important. Go ahead, Paul.
I just want to challenge the open space thing. I do believe it's important to have dialogue, and as I mentioned earlier, we can have these gatherings at Red Emma's or anywhere, and again, preach to the choir. When I did Rewind, I invited everyone to come in. Actually, I'm thinking that I'm sure that Klan members came to my show. Actually, all three showings of my Klan robes, because people view them in different ways. But I feel it's important to have people that disagree with us, white people, give them a safe place. I know this sounds odd, but give them a safe place to talk about their shame, because there's so many situations where we've made their shame, our shame, in a sense that, you know, slavery is not Black America's shame. But yet, Black people have a harder time talking about it than other people. So I think in having these conversations, we create this bubble, and now we're realizing the dangers of bubbles this past few weeks, you know, especially in this past week. But I think we really need to figure out ways of getting out and reaching out to people that we don't always agree with, and have that long conversation and providing a safe place for everyone.
And it's an uncomfortable place. I mean, see, one of the things that I think artists like photojournalists do, what you're talking about, this heat piece, whatever else you're doing, is those are images that are universally seen, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they're in your face. You can look away if you want, but they're there, and you have to address it somehow. That's why I think that's a very powerful kind of tool to
And when I talk about that safe space in the classroom, I'm not talking about it being – I mean, it is going to be a bubble just because of sort of who's in the room and what the conversation is. But I do think that in an institution like MICA, where we definitely have a liberal slant to most of the conversations, I want it to be a space where if someone comes from a different background, they feel comfortable saying what they feel. And one of the things within that class that I would oftentimes do is refer to my own upbringing. and which went in a very different way than the bulk of the people in the class, but it opened up a conversation and levels of trust to sort of share the experiences back and forth.
Yeah, I know for when I was visiting artists at MICA for 2 years, I know for a fact that there were students that were to the right who did not feel safe and did not feel they had a voice there.
Right.
And it was obvious, and they were very quiet in situations. When the room can rally and get excited about something, but you can tell that not everyone agrees with the issues. I mean, and we do associate with art schools of being left and you know, forward thinking, but that's not always the case. And I think it's a difficult situation for some of them to be in. And then you also have the barrier of people coming from other cultures, students that come from the Pacific Rim. They will not understand, our relationship, black, white, our history. And also, it took me a while to understand, the relationship between South Korea and Japan and that tumultuous history. I mean, when I have friends, exactly, when you know it, and you realize, wow. But expecting someone else to understand our culture and our issues, or even agreeing with our issues when they might actually have right wing or right leaning ideology when they come from another country as well.
We do have to go a very quick break. We're going to come right back. 410-319-8888. We'll pick up on that. I can see you want to pick up on that. And we're going to pick up on those points when we come back from this break as we look at artists and social change and the exhibit now at MICA and what the role of the artists in all of this. 410-319-8888. We'll be back in just a minute. Don't go away. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Stein, and we're having a conversation in part inspired by the work at MICA now, this new exhibit up, Baltimore Rising, new exhibition, which is at the Fred Lazarus, the 4th Center for Graduate Studies on North Avenue. And it's pretty amazing. There'll be a panel coming up on the 16th of November. That's next week, isn't it?
It's this Wednesday. It's tomorrow.
Actually, it's tomorrow, not next week.
Yeah, right.
What year is this?
1968.
Sometimes it is.
It's 1915, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know what year it is sometimes. But anyway, tomorrow night on November 16th from 7 to 9 p.m., there'll be a panel discussion on the exhibit at Lazarus Center Auditorium. Considering this question, what is the role of the arts in revolution? Every artist who's in our show today will be on the panel as well as answering great questions. And they're here in the studio, so let's ask them that question right now. J.M. Giordano is photographer, photo editor of the Baltimore City Paper. Paul Rucker is a visual artist, musician, winner of the Becker Award. His work was just in the BMA, and his piece, you're putting a new one up there, right?
Maybe. Not the BMA.
No, I mean at MICA.
You have two pieces in the...
Oh, yeah, there's a new one up. Yeah, I'll explain that in a minute as well.
I want to check that out. Yes. Tony Shore, who's chairperson of the painting department at MICA, who curated this exhibit, Baltimore Rising. So what about the role of that? We had a bunch of revolutionaries on the last hour talking about politics. What about the role of the artist in revolution?
I think it's extremely important. I mean, the whole point of...
G.M. Giordano.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the especially with photography.
JM.
Yeah, especially with still photography. I mean, it's very important to get... the message of revolution out to the people that may not see it otherwise, and it's also a symbol that we're not taking it lying down, the whole point of the revolution. And I just think that the arts are extremely important. I don't know now, because they're so commercialized, if they're not, I wouldn't say not as important, but maybe relevant, because you're so inundated with art every day, all the time, on every device. So it's going to be harder to for artists in the coming years to maybe to kind of rise above that social media din. But I'm going to keep at it. I'm going to keep shooting stories that no one else is working on to make sure people see what's going on in the city.
And
sure.
I can't help but go back to probably one of my favorite quotes that gets attributed to Queen Victoria, but it's, "Beware the artists, for they move amongst the classes and are therefore the most dangerous." I think as someone who is an artist, that's...
Say that again. I love that. Do that one more time.
beware the artists, because they move amongst the classes and are therefore the most dangerous. And I mean, my own work has dealt with class for a long time and sort of moving back and forth. And I just think that as people who make products, you know, in the living situations that we're in, which are usually not the healthiest or wealthiest, and then potentially selling products to people of a different class, it gives us an opportunity to sort of step foot into different areas. And I think that, you know, that idea of sort of making light or bringing things into the light for people to see, as artists, we open this window and allow other people to see into worlds that they may not be aware of. And so with that ability to sort of move back and forth, I almost feel sometimes like we get to collect information from both sides and that we also get to influence opinion on both sides.
Paul?
I've been really concerned lately about, the NEA funding right now is, $150 million. It's nothing much. But I see that as being under fire. It may disappear quickly. And yeah. I think people are not thinking about, because when I think about revolutionaries, when I think about the power of art, I always think of Bob Marley and how he was so influential and so powerful. I mean, there were people that were razor blading, tracks out before the albums were sold in some areas because he could spark a revolution. And, in bringing the light to the things that need to be seen, and nothing's more dangerous than uniting people. Nothing's more dangerous than people organizing for a cause. And I think art has played a huge role in that. I mean, even if it's something that's not intended to be just art, like the I Am a Man posters from the sanitation workers strike in Memphis. I mean, that's one of my favorite pieces.
1968 we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I mean, it's a powerful, powerful piece. And so I think our role is there, but there has to be policy and there has to be action along with the art. Now, art alone is not going to be good enough for the next few years, and it never really has been.
Folks, join us, 410-319-8888. Your ideas and thoughts on this. A lot of artists listen to this program. We'd love to hear from you, whether you're kind of withdrawn into your studio or out there in the midst of it. 410-319-8888. Write to us here by email, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Just don't get too much paint on your cell phone when you do that. 410-319-8888. What were we going to say, Paul?
Yeah, I wanted to make a clarification about the current piece that I have in the show, When We Were Useful, the slaves that were brought to life on a $100 Confederate bill.
Yeah.
That was a last-minute piece because the piece that I intend to have in the show that's in the show now that's just been added is called In Her Words. I actually changed the title from something else. But the piece actually addresses Brock Turner, the convicted rapist.
Yeah.
Ex-Stanford swimmer,
right,
who served 3 months in jail, not prison, in jail for sexual assault. And I think when we look at the disproportionality in prosecution and selective enforcement laws, we also need to look at the other side, which is privilege and people who are able to go over in the system. And he's just a poster child, one of many people who have gotten over, in quotation marks, on a system. And so for this piece, I took the victim's 13-page letter that she wrote, an open letter. It was a powerful letter. And I took that and I made his mugshot from those words and letters. And it's a 13-minute video, and I'll let you see it.
It's up there now?
It's up there now.
I'll slide on by my way back to the office here, our studios. Now I can check that out. Yeah. Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Fatima, you're on the air. Welcome.
How are you?
Very well, Fatima. Welcome to the show.
Good. I listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was trying to find out, you keep talking about mica, but there are some people who may not be informed as to where it is. And I'm trying to find out where it is, the address and everything. I definitely want to see the exhibition.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for pulling us up about that. So, the Maryland Institute College of Art, but
the building that the exhibition is located in is at 131 West North Avenue. It's the Fred Lazarus IV Center, and it's also where the panel will be taking place tomorrow night between 7 and 9.
And tomorrow night, 7 to 9, that should be really good. Just go wander through. I mean, it's right next to.
It's right in between Maryland Avenue and Howard Street.
Right by Snack.
Yeah, It's Who's connected snack? To snack.
Right. Yes, you can get a Nancy. Snack and
Nancy's,
not Nancy's. Snacks. Snacks around the corner. Yeah. Nancy's, thank
Nancy's.
You. Thank you. So that's where it is. We'll also post that, and we'll say it again at the end of the show. We have a lot of people calling in. 410-319-8888. Amania, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well. Good morning.
Great.
Good morning. I love listening to your show. I just wanted to comment that I am a historic preservationist, and the things that are going on in our country right now, to me, are not new. And they aren't surprising if you understand history. And I think that this election has really opened up a lot of people's minds and eyes to the history that they haven't learned or they haven't understood. And they asked me, you know, how do you know all this stuff about 1968? And what do you mean when you talk about Hoover? And why do you feel like he is going to be the next Hitler? Why do you understand fascism? I tell them all the time that you have to preserve our history. You have to learn it. And artists are the best way to express history and teach history to those who may not just pick up a book and read about it and who may not just go to a museum. Artists are just the link for that. And we really have to utilize artists and merge it with history and make sure that our young people are really getting the history portion of it. And I really respect your work, and it sounds absolutely beautiful, because in order for people to even know what you're talking about and know what you're talking about when you say Emancipation Proclamation, and that Baltimore has such a rich history and civil rights that is underlooked, and just, if you understand that Maryland is, these students are protesting and getting excited, that's because Maryland has that history behind it. We have that type of that conversation a lot, and people just don't connect the dots, and artists are there to connect the dots for us. And so I respect all of your work that you do. I hope that you guys keep doing it throughout the revolution. We're going to really need for artists to step up and educate these kids who don't know how to get the information anymore. It's so muddled down. People don't research. They just Google
right.
it. Like, I'm in the archives all the time, so I know what it is to really pick up something and read a transcript, a letter between two senators about Negroes. You know, I know what that means. We haven't had these conversations before with these kids, and we really need to, and I respect the artists for stepping up and taking their spot and their role for that.
Imani, thank you so much for your thoughts, and I deeply appreciate that. I think that Jam, you want to jump in here, but let me just say that on the way to you that the artist does play a special role. So to me, the artist, what we do in art, whether it's in video and audio production or whether it's in graphics and painting or whether it's in photography, whatever that is interpreting things visually, auditorially, that and otherwise that people can grab a hold of and feel that can move them to something else. I really do think that's a really powerful role that art plays in all this.
First of all, I wanted to say to Amani that my wife's an archivist, so you keep doing what you're doing.
That's right.
To society.
Yes.
Super important. Going all the way back to Egypt. We know about that stuff because back then there was still an archivist. So you keep doing what you're doing.
Amen to that.
And I just wanted to jump in because I think also the burden of this history falls on educational institutions also. There was a really sad letter read on the Diane Rehm show on NPR from an African-American teacher in D.C. from one of his students, a female student, who said that they don't know how government works. Mm-hmm. These civics classes are being cut. These history classes
right.
are being cut.
Right.
So they don't know that the three branches of government. And all they know is from what they get online and on Google. So that needs to change also. I think we need to artists have a role in it, but we need to go back to the educators as well.
Yeah. With the again, thanks for that. That's really important. I mean, we could actually, if you can go back where Joe was talking about, you know, the amendments. I mean, how many of us know the amendments and the ones we've lost and the ones that we're losing or we're about to lose? It's really, really important. And when you have Texas, textbooks that are trying to redefine slavery as migrant workers, I mean, that's trying to change the narrative of things. So having these archives and having accurate information about our history is really, really important because there are a lot of folks that have no idea of not just what happened, you know, 100 years ago or even, you know, even 10 years ago. I mean, a lot of the Patriot Act things that have been happening, that where our rights have been diminished. But I think Joe's also right about the curriculum in schools. I think we need to actually look at our curriculum. We need to look at history from a Howard Zinn perspective, not just, you know, we need to question all aspects of how the narrative is framed in our history books.
No, absolutely. I mean, let me go back to the phones. You'll tell me one of Jim, and I'll go back to the phones.
No, I guess, in going back to some of one of the earlier callers had talked about sort of the use of language, and he had mentioned the three-fifths. And it's interesting because I think we're skimming over some of the amazing work that's in this show, but there is a piece that's called Three-Fifths by Sonia Clark. And it's a men's white button-down shirt with three cornrows taking up the back three-fifths of the shirt that also start to feel like lashes on a back. And it's a really powerful, dramatically lit piece that, you know, I think those terms that we look back at and that we question also need to be a part of the education. They can't just be thrown out. I think, you know, when someone sees that title and then they ask, what's that mean? I mean, just the other day when we were installing the show, shortly before it opened, there was a student walking through who was African-American with three international students. And just to see her start to explain to these international students sort of what the work was about and the importance of, you know, what the Confederate flag means. Because there's another piece by that same artist, Sonia Clark, called Unraveled, where she's taken a Confederate flag and completely unraveled it string by string to the point where there's just a shelf with three piles of red, white, and blue thread. And
it's an amazing piece. I love that piece.
Yeah.
And my favorite piece in the show.
Yeah.
You don't even realize at first glance. And then when you get up, I mean, she's literally deconstructing this major symbol of our country's racism. And the power of that, I think, is a really amazing. And there's so many pieces in the show that have stories like that. There's a piece by Logan Hicks called Freddie Gray's Day, which is just sort of at first glance the scene of sort of a Baltimore back alley. And Logan's medium that he works with is spray paint and stencils. And in the midst of the layers of the spray paint, you see there are these three spinal cords sort of embedded into the spray paint. And it's just a really powerfully moving piece.
And I was some of the others I'm remembering looking through the book again is like Olivia Robinson's pieces.
Oh yeah.
That mm-hmm. Near and Far Enemies, and what she put in that in her a tapestry was just unbelievable. I mean, the maps and trees.
And it's a map connected to redlining with the actual charts that were given to, given to the banks for which neighborhoods were safer neighborhoods to keep the loans from going out to certain people to live in certain neighborhoods, and how that correlates currently even with the size of trees in communities. You wouldn't think that sort of our racist history would dictate what we see as nature in Baltimore today.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. We'll get to all these calls coming in. Owusu, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning, Mark, and to your guest.
Good morning.
The earlier caller alluded to the importance of our youngsters knowing history, which I wholeheartedly agree. But I found that, you know, I work a lot with the youngsters, both on the collegiate level and also in the elementary schools, and sometimes there's resistance against just drawing all attention to slavery, and that story needs to be told, as does the rebellion. But often overlooked are the technical and scientific contributions of Africans in terms of agriculture. I'm an agriculturist by training, and you know, going all the way back to ancient Egypt with all the knowledge in terms of irrigation, going to the West Africa. All the knowledge in terms of the production of rice, and actually enslaved Africans were purposely brought in from the Gambian area in Africa because of their knowledge of rice growing. So my point is that in telling the history of our people in terms of enslavement, we not to whitewash the brutality of it, but also in art and in conversations to highlight some of the scientific contributions of Africans.
I appreciate it. We're always going to hear from our listeners in Baton Rouge. It's good to have you call in. And I think that, you know, go ahead, Paul. I mean, I think that there's so many elements to that. I mean, we sometimes people like to kind of take George Washington Carver, let's say, and push him to the side because he's an appeaser, some people would argue. He was a liberation fighter in his own right. And B, I've always maintained, we had a show about this last year, that George Washington Carver is really the father of sustainable agriculture in this country. Mm-hmm. What he created, what he tried to do, and the seeds he created. I mean, and so it goes on and on. I'm sorry, Paul, go ahead.
No, I agree with the caller and also disagree in the sense that I attended the African American Culture Museum in D.C. and I felt really proud when I left. They have a section on inventors, you know, people in agriculture, people, architects, I mean, social, like AKA and, you know, different for social fraternities. And they had not as much on lynching or slavery that I'd like. And I'm glad that someone like Brian Stevenson, who's building a museum around lynching in Montgomery, Alabama right now, because it's an important aspect of our history. But I think for me, I'm one of the things that I do with my Rewind exhibition is I have Klan ropes that I've been making. And I wanted people to see that the Klan was not just significant, it's still here in its changed form. And it's still very powerful. I mean, there were three waves of the Klan, and the second wave of the Klan happened after the Birth of a Nation movie came out, which ignited the base, and it said, well, people organized, and a lot of that organization came through fear. And I imagine nothing like that would ever happen today. But in 1920 alone, the Klan population was 15% of the U.S. population, which was 4 to 5 million people. And I think that is just as an important bit of information that we didn't know when we're talking about history, the significance of these groups, such as the Klan. And I think it's important to talk about the positive and the good things, but I also think it's important to acknowledge the not-so-pretty aspects. And I learned after leaving the African American Culture Museum, why did this take so long? Well, because I felt really proud when I left, and that's probably one thing that some people didn't want to happen. I felt really, really proud.
When you left the museum in D.C.?
Yeah, it's a great museum. They've done a fantastic job.
I can't wait to go. I've not been yet. I'm looking forward to spending an entire day there just wandering through, and they have to get tickets in advance, but I'm looking forward to doing that. 410-319-8888. John, you're on the air. Welcome.
Question. The guy who's talking about his race, gender, class, art.
Yes.
In art class at MICA, and you mentioned that you wanted you're going to reestablish it and then have something involved with a no cell phone policy and people's thinking is being taken out of context.
Yes.
Can you go into detail about exactly what happened? It sounds like there's a story there.
There's not so much a story as I think even sort of leading up to this election. I think there are issues of sort of conversations happening on college campuses that can lead into sort of the idea of trigger warnings or all of these sort of that you have to prepare students for classes where certain conversations are going to happen so that you may not sort of affect them. And I think that oftentimes it seems as though in the educational system, there's been a lot of critique as to sort of what is the valuable experience and also keeping it accessible for everyone. And I don't know, it gets pretty pretty deep going back and forth. There's a great a short clip from Obama where he was actually visiting a school and he was talking to the students there. And it goes back to some of what Paul was saying earlier of this idea of, like, you need to be able to confront those things that you don't agree with. Obama was referring to he heard that schools were not allowing certain speakers to come because they disagreed with what they were saying. And his response was, no, it's actually very important that you have those people here so that you have that conversation. And they may change your mind, you may change their mind, or it may end up the same way, but you need to have those conversations and you can't avoid them. It's important that you get to sort of address those issues. And I think in this particular class that I'm talking about, I want to sort of keep that openness and not have to worry about if someone did complain. Or, I mean, in this class, we would spend a whole day on the N-word. And here I am, the white guy at the front of the room, teaching this class where we spend a day on the N-word. And, you know, it needs to be the place where that conversation can happen. And that I can play devil's advocate when I need to provoke a conversation so that we actually have those deeper thoughts.
I think that's kind of really critical in all of our classes. I mean, that, you know, you've got to challenge. And I think that, you know, I was thinking about the class we taught at UMBC last semester, and they were trying to reconstitute in many ways, which is how you take things like using art to let people express what they've learned in class as opposed to just writing a paper. You know, whether it's a film, an audio piece, a visual piece. Because that's, to me, the way we communicate. It's a way to grab something in the gut and the heart that can fuel the mind to take a different turn or to think and look in a deeper way.
It's also about processing for yourself. I mean, I made a piece about Emmett Till because I didn't learn about Emmett Till, and I was blown away by this story. I made a piece recently about Jesse Washington. This is the 100th anniversary of his lynching that was viewed by 10,000 plus people, where he was burned at the stake for 2 hours, and he was castrated. His fingers were cut off, and parts were saved as souvenirs. And this is an important part of our history. He was a 17-year-old mentally disabled black gentleman in Waco, Texas in 1916. So this is a part of history that's an atrocity that we need to realize can happen again and has happened again in a different form. My challenge, I know we're getting close to the end. My thing is that it's really important that we have some sort of deep listening. The best advances that I've made have not been in the gallery lately. The best advances I've made with people and engaging has been in airports and flights, because I fly about every week. And on the plane, I talk with someone and I listen to them. And a lot of times you'll have someone that doesn't agree with you. And you ask them, so why do you feel this way? And then I listen. I practice deep listening. And sometimes they'll realize that what they're saying is absolutely ludicrous and it's off. And it's one of the best things that I've learned from this whole process. And it's easy, again, to go to the gallery because I'm in a safe place, and I want to be a little more unsafe as we go on.
So let's turn to Jam before we run out of time. We haven't said anything in a minute or two.
Yeah, man. Well, this really isn't my department with academia and things like that. I mean, I think all this right-wing nonsense about trigger warnings is kind of silly. I mean, I think because us, and then, you know, we're complacent. I'm in the media, so I'm complacent. By putting a label on it, I mean, you have warnings before television shows, right? This show contains graphic violence and blah, blah, blah. And that's not called a trigger warning. But, you know, the right put a label on this, and a lot of these kids are under fire because all they want to do is go to a place where they just want to know what's going on in the classroom. So, I mean, I don't have much to say on the academia smart.
Well, we got like 30 seconds left. You want to give us 30 seconds?
Yeah, the one thing that I also just wanted to point out as a large part of the community engagement part of this show was that we did make these catalogs. So because the show is such a short run, and the
Too
catalogs
short.
are really great. They have an essay from DeRay McKesson and from Leslie King Hammond. And they've got, you know, some words from each of the artists, but they're also for sale for $10 a piece, and all of the proceeds are going to go to Jubilee Arts.
So tell me where. So the address again.
Oh, 131 West North Avenue.
And it runs through November the 23rd. So go check this out. And tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, there is a panel discussion. What is the role of the arts and revolution taking place at the Lazarus Center Auditorium there? At the spot where where the exhibit is. So I want to thank you all for being here. Tony Schur, chairperson of Painting Department, Micah, who is a curator. Good to see you, Tony. Good to have you here. My good friend Paul Rucker, good to have you in the studio, man.
Thanks for having me.
Our great artist here living in Baltimore now, James Giordano, man who provokes our world with his photography. Good to have you here in the studio as
Thanks
well.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
And thank you all for calling in, tuning in, and being part of the show today. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. Podcast Mark Steiner Show, and share with your friends at steinershow.org, or use your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.